Execution Watch and KPFT are member-sponsored. The money that makes Execution Watch possible comes from listeners like you. If you care about what you hear, please support KPFT and Execution Watch by going to kpft.org and making a donation. It's tax-deductible, and every bit counts. Thank you.
If Texas has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where Texas is preparing to put Robert Garza to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage and commentary on the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee. Huntsville reporter outside the death house Gloria Rubeck, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood. Featured guest Robert Garza, who taped an interview with Execution Watch yesterday on death row. The Execution Watch for Robert Garza begins.
Well, good evening. This is an execution day. My name is Ray Hill. I am the host of Execution Watch. Our producer, Elizabeth Stein, Mark Pertle from Houston Media Source, and I were in Livingston yesterday to interview Robert Garza. Robert Garza's process is about to begin. We need a report from Huntsville. Is that Gloria? We have Gloria on the line. Gloria, this is Ray. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Ray.
What's going on?
Well, we've got a large group of people out here supporting Bobby Garza. The Supreme Court has still not ruled. I just hung up from talking to the Public Information Office. So, for those that are listening, the fat lady hadn't sung yet. I have no earthly idea when
okay.
they ruled.
Okay, I can explain that to the listeners. What is the mood of the vigilance there?
Well, there's a lot of people out here. Bobby's little brother Eric and his sister Corey are standing out here. The mood is somber because most of us who are out here know the family. We know the mom. We know the sister and brother. We know the wife. So it's somber. We're just waiting to find out if anybody in this stupid country has anything like justice on their mind, and that they're opposed to killing somebody who didn't kill anybody.
Gloria, who among the family is not with you? Who plans to go into the chamber if that comes to that?
His mom is going to witness, Sylvia Garza. His wife, Jennifer's going to witness. And her friend, Yadira, is going to witness. Is Sylvia's husband going in? Okay, so Sylvia's husband is going in also. And who else? Huh? I'm not sure.
Okay, but the rest of the family would be out there with you.
Well, Bobby's sister, Corey, who is a junior in high school, is out here. And his little brother, Eric, who must be in, I don't know, sixth grade? He's 10 years old. He's in fifth grade.
Where are the children? Where's Bobby's children?
Bobby's children, I don't know. Perhaps they're at the hospital. You know what? I don't even know if Jennifer has the kids up here.
Okay. There was talk with her mother yesterday about they're going back to the valley with her. Okay. We're going to drop this line, and we want you to call us back, and you know the number to call immediately if something happens. And if we do not get that call, call in and let's celebrate together, all right?
Oh, I hope that's going to be the situation, Ray. I really do. And are we on live tonight?
We're on live tonight.
Okay,
we're being videotaped here tonight.
I asked
somebody at the vigil to hold up their cell phone and take some shots of the vigil.
Okay.
So that we can splice all of that in because this
I
is being
stories filming.
This is being televised. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Gloria.
Right, well, I want to tell Bobby's friends on the road that there's a lot of us out. There's over 25 people out here, and that we're still hoping and praying and wishing that there's going to be some justice.
Thank you, Gloria Ruback. And Gloria Ruback is attached with the abolition movement. And you can get in touch with Gloria through abolitionmovement.org. All right, Dave, are you there?
I am, Ray.
And where is there?
We're in front of St. Stephen's Church on West Alabama.
Okay.
And we also have a fairly good turnout considering the rain and everything. We've got about 12 people here.
That's good. There's a lot of interest in Bobby's execution all over the state.
Yeah.
And folks are looking at it. I can give you the good news.
Okay.
That nobody has crossed the road.
That's good.
And I need to tell the rest of the listeners that the first thing we know about the process beginning is when we get a report from Gloria that the witnesses, first the media witnesses, then the family witnesses, have crossed the road. And
right.
We have not had such a report at this time. Things are pending before the Supreme Court. The Texas AG's office announced the Supreme Court was going to rule just before 6 o'clock. If there is a delay in that, it is because the Supreme Court has wanted to listen to a pro se motion filed by Bobby himself about some exculpatory evidence that was not provided his attorneys.
Okay. All right. Well, good. Ray, too, I mentioned to you that we did take a picture of a group out here, so I could send that to you this evening.
Yes, Mark Pirtle, well, he's not going to be doing editing today anyway, but Mark Pirtle would get it. Just get in touch. Give it, if you can email it to me, I can forward it.
Okay, will do. All right.
And,
okay, well, let's hope for the best.
Okay, but you've got a coming event coming up soon for the... death penalty group that you're involved in.
There's a luncheon speaker, Catherine Case, is going to speak on the 26th at St. Anne's Church.
Westheimer and Shepherd.
Right, Westheimer and Shepherd, and we'd like, when she's going to give us an update on developments on the death penalty in Texas, and probably we'll be speaking about that new ABA report that just came out. So we'd like everybody to come out to that. If they go to our website, tcadp.org, they can get the details on it.
And TCADP is a acronym for?
Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty.
TCADP.org. Is there anticipated to be a charge for this event? People should...
No, there's no charge. If you want somebody to bring a sandwich for you, you should register for the sandwich, for the food, but there's no charge to attend the event, and you can come and either bring your own food or not eat. One of the two, but there's no charge for the event. I think it'll be very interesting and very educational because Catherine really knows what's going on in the state of Texas.
But folks should RSVP for space.
Right, right.
All right. Thank you very much, David. Give our regards to the vigilance there.
I will. Okay, Ray. Thank you.
Thank you. And that was Dave Atwood with TDC, or Texas. I got to look it up. I'm sorry. I have to apologize. The Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, TCADP.org. Jim, what happened in this case?
Well, this case began in a bar.
Wait a minute. Your microphone's not hot. Okay, here it comes.
Where are we on now?
You're better, but not... Here. Here he goes. Now you're on.
Oh, now we got it fixed up.
Yeah.
The genesis of this case began in a little town called Donna, Texas. And those who are not familiar with Donna, it's in the very lower Rio Grande Valley. It's just... but kind of not halfway, but it's in between Brownsville and McAllen, directly on the border. And there's a bar called Garcia's. And sometime in 2002, there had been a shooting in the bar, and a man had been charged with attempted murder. The man charged with attempted murder was a member of a gang called the Tri-City Bombers. It was a gang in the Rio Grande Valley. And the gang put out a hit on a barmaid by the name of Nora Rodriguez, who was going to testify against the shooter. And so they ordered a hit. Robert Garza was a member of the Tri-City Bombers, and he and another man were the ones that received the orders to kill Norma Rodriguez. So they put together a group of guys, and they went to the bar in two separate cars. And the bar closed around midnight there. That was back in the days when bars closed at midnight. And what happened, there were seven barmaids working at the bar. And six of them, they all lived in a trailer house together, and they're all illegal immigrants. It was kind of sad because they were here undocumented workers. And the one they were really after, Norma Rodriguez, stayed behind to clean up the bar. And six of the girls got in one car and drove to a trailer house where they were living. And the people from the Tri-City, there was a number of guys in the Tri-City Bombers, followed them home. As soon as the girls got home, they opened up fire on the car and shot 61 rounds of bullets into the car. Mm. There were six young ladies in the car. Four of them were killed and two survived. And then when they had left the bar, the case went unsolved for some time. They suspected some type of gang activity, but they couldn't tell for certain. Then the following January, there was another incident in which the Tri-City Bombers invaded another gang to rob a gang stash house in Edinburgh, ended up killing six people in that particular case. You got a total at this point of 10 dead people. And they suspected Robert Garcia as being the involved in both cases. So they arrested him about a month after the shootings in Edinburgh, where he had six dead people. He admitted on the Edinburgh killings where six people were killed. When he was picked up, he admitted being present at the scene where the killings took place. He admitted being one of the shooters when the six people were killed. There are a total of eight people in the house in that incident, two survived. So he admitted being a shooter in that case. So the notion that he didn't really kill anybody is kind of hard to believe because you got 10 dead people he was involved with. So what happened after he confessed to that a couple of days later, this matched the description of kind of what occurred in the Donna bomb and the Donna killings, the barroom killings. So they questioned him again, and so he finally admitted the following. He admitted to the police that, number one, that he and another man had the contract to kill the barmaid who was going to testify against a fellow gang member. He admitted going to the scene, he admitted help setting it up, but he denied ever shooting, doing any of the shooting. Mm-hmm. And that was the case they chose to try because he was charged with the capital murders of the six young men, charged with the capital murders of the four young women. But the state chose to try the case involving the four young women.
How are such decisions made?
DAs make that decision. Mike Gillespie and I talked about that. I think Mike's going to comment a little bit further about it later in the program. But they could have tried on either of the cases. And from a law viewpoint, the strongest case was with the Edinburgh killing of the six men because he admitted being a shooter in that one. Mm-hmm. This one he denied being the shooter. And that's basically the case. You have a confession made by him, plus you have other evidence from other eyewitnesses that saw him.
Do you know where these cases were tried?
In Edinburgh County.
Edinburgh County.
It's called Hidalgo County. It's tried in Edinburgh, Texas, and those of you not familiar with that.
Yeah, I know. Edinburgh, I've been at the E. Roy Brown trial. It was tried in
Other people in the audience may not be. Mm-hmm. Edinburgh is right next to Cameron County, which is the very bottommost county in Texas. Yeah. It's directly on the border.
This happened in Edinburgh County as opposed to Cameron County.
It happened in Hidalgo County, in Edinburgh's county seat.
Okay.
And Susan's going to talk about what happened at punishment.
So, having once sorted through these cases and decided where they're going to go with it, why is punishment even important?
Well, he could get life or death, so it'd be important to him.
Otis, I've got a microphone problem here. Okay, let's try it again.
Well, it'd be very important to him. It'd be life or death for him. So, of course, it'd be very important for him.
Yeah.
I mean, at punishment, it's kind of unusual here. At punishment, the state puts on evidence that he had a bad juvenile record. He was a gang member since he was very young, like 9 years old. He was sent to a Hidalgo County village for boys, which I guess presumably you have some misconduct to get there. Mm-hmm. And from there, he went to TYC. And, I mean, he's only 20 years old. He went to TYC for burglary of a habitation.
Really? TYC explains the reforms.
Okay. it's sometimes referred to as juvenile jail.
Yeah.
Okay. He tries to escape, but there's nothing, I mean, okay, there's nothing, shall we say, heinous there. The unusual thing is the state filed notice to put on evidence of the Edinburgh killings, which was loosely called in the news media the Edinburgh Massacre.
Okay.
The state filed notice that they would intended to put on that evidence, but at the punishment phase of the trial, they did not put on that evidence. They could have put on that evidence through his confession to the police.
At the punishment phase, they can put on damn near anything they want to.
Right, but they had three methods of getting on that evidence. They could put on his statement to the police, his confession, where he admits to being there and being the shooter. They had two eyewitnesses that survived the killings. They could have put on the testimony of, you know, the two eyewitnesses. And they also had police investigators that investigated the case and, shall we say, felt confident that he was, you know, involved in one of the shooters.
He had two women. There's also an informant that explained everything that happened, so
okay.
They had him also.
Right. So they had, in other words, they had ample ways to get that evidence on. The state elected clearly not to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've all been discussing why.
Why
would the state not do that? In other words, like Jim was saying, well, maybe they probably had a stronger case on the Edinburgh Massacre than the killings of the women, although they elected to go on the killings of the women.
And he had already been convicted of the killings of the women before they got to punishment phase.
What he's...
He was found guilty.
He
was already guilty, so they had that in the bag, and I guess they just decided we've maxed out here.
Well, they can only kill him one time, too, Ray.
Yeah, I know, they can only kill him one time.
We're not talking about why they didn't try him. They didn't work on why they didn't introduce evidence.
Yeah.
Why they didn't introduce evidence, I mean, it could have been that the two eyewitnesses that are survivors, they might be reluctant to testify against him because, after all, the trial was about killing women. What the basis of the killing of the women was supposedly to stop someone from testifying. So the eyewitnesses might have been reluctant or not wanted to testify, although I'll point out there was his confession and there was also they could call police officers. Why the state elected not to do it is just hard to say.
Now, incorrect? At the punishment phase, it's a series of questions to be answered about future dangerousness.
It's just, they call them special issues, and really it boils down to one issue. Truthfully, will he be a danger in the future? And that's really the issue the jury answers yes or no. If they say yes and there's no mitigating factors, then it's an automatic death sentence.
And he was 19 years old at the time.
At the time, he was 19.
But I will also point this out. The killing of the women, you have a situation where there's a group of young women that are working at a bar. They close the bar. They leave the bar. They're working all night. They all go to a mobile home. These are young women that have, you know, no involvement in any gang criminal activity.
They weren't even the target.
I mean, they're just innocent young girls working as barmaids, and they're gunned down by a group of guys.
Mm-hmm.
On the Edinburgh Massacre, the attack was on another gang stash house. So perhaps the state thought it was more sympathetic, the killings of the, shall we say, innocent young women.
The image we have created with this evidence could be confused by other images.
Well, the difference is that these
point of future dangerousness.
well, in other words, attacking these young women, which supposedly they made a mistake, the one that they really wanted to kill, I guess, was still at the bar closing it down. And the other girls they followed had nothing to... They were not going to testify. So, in effect, these young girls were just killed by mistake.
Okay. I need to talk to the audience a little bit. I would like to point out that no one has crossed the road. No one has gone into the execution house to witness an execution. And that means to us that this process has not happened. What's going on right now is that Robert Garza is in the execution chamber. Chances are they do not have needles in his arm, but he is either near or on the gurney. He probably doesn't control his movement at all. And the witnesses are across the street awaiting to be ushered to the witness chairs in execution chamber. And the state is waiting word from the Supreme Court of the United States whether it is appropriate to proceed. We have been here before on the execution watch. The last time we were here, you will recall, Jim, they didn't execute the fellow until about an hour after we went off.
We were home and pretty much in bed by the time they did it.
And so there is an execution scheduled tonight. It is of Robert Garza. We're going to continue with the story of Robert Garza's case. He may or may not get executed. It depends on the very thin thread. His attorney did not file the motion that is before the court. It was filed in Hidalgo County Court, pro se, by Robert Garza himself, and it deals with the license plates of the cars present at the time of the shooting. They found the license plate of the car in a chop shop. And they knew the whereabouts of that car, but the state, the district attorney in Hidalgo County trying the case, did not inform Robert Garza's attorney of that fact. That is what you call exculpatory evidence, and the defense should have been informed of it. The significance of it is going to be determined in the minds of Supreme Court justices tonight, the highest court in this land. Am I right about that, Larry?
Yeah.
That the Supreme Court of the United States is looking to see if this is the real stuff or not and worth a delay in this execution.
That's what's being decided right now.
The key is going to be on that, and the magic word material.
Material.
It's got to be material evidence that was withheld. Material meaning, him thinking about the law clause about material. Material means there's a likelihood the verdict would have been different on guilt or innocence, or would have been different on punishment. It's going to be real hard to prove under this set of facts with four dead people that it would have materially changed the outcome of the trial, either on guilt or innocence or punishment.
So that is the thin thread on which Robert Garza's life jangled. Thank you very much, Susan, for helping us with punishment. Larry, you've got a call.
Okay, the important thing here is the state did not, not only did the state did not put on evidence of the Edinburgh massacre, when the state did not put on evidence of the Edinburgh massacre, the defense elected not to put on any evidence at punishment. Okay, they put on no mitigation evidence.
No.
Because the defense obviously was concerned that if they tried to put on some mitigation evidence,
that would open up a door.
That the state would respond with the Edinburgh massacre. And the defense did, but the defense had prepared for it, and they tried to develop some mitigating evidence to put on, and they hired two psychologists. But what happened with the two psychologists? Let's just say it wouldn't have materialized positively for Garza.
Okay, Larry, what you got?
Well, Ray, we have a situation here where Robert Garza was found guilty of capital murder. And sentenced to death for a shooting where the evidence, there's no evidence to show that he actually shot anybody. Mm-hmm. So as a result, that raises some confusion in some people's minds as to how can you be sentenced to death for somebody that there's no evidence that you actually did the killing. And the problem Robert Garza has is that that's the way people normally think. So when he gave his statement, was that, you know, well, I assisted and we did this all together, but I didn't shoot anybody. Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, under the Texas law, there's something called the law of parties. Specifically, there's a provision in the law where a person can be held criminally responsible for the actions of another person. Not your actions, but the actions of another person based on certain factors. And if you act with the intent to promote or assist in the commission of the offense, or if you solicit or encourage or direct or aid or attempt to aid that person in committing the act. Well, Robert Garza, I think, was lulled into a false sense of security saying, well, since I didn't shoot anybody, then I can't be held responsible for this. So he gave a statement without a lawyer, And rather than just saying, I need to have a lawyer, I need to have a lawyer, he may have been comforted in the fact that his claim was, I didn't shoot anybody. But what did I do? Well, he did admit that that there was a hit that was organized for them, mm-hmm. meaning himself, and that they received instructions to do the hit, and that he prepared for the hit, that he followed the gunman over to the trailer, which probably was enough.
Yeah.
But then he follows that with a denial of responsibility that, well, since I didn't shoot anybody, you guys can't do anything to hold me responsible for it. And unfortunately, under Texas law, that's just not the case.
All right, we're going to break here. And Otis, if you've got the interview with Robert Garza ready, we're going to listen to Robert Garza talking about some of the same things the lawyers have been talking about here. And I want to tell you all that this show is being videotaped. The interview with Robert Garza was videotaped at the Polunsky unit in the visit room. And all of this is going to be packaged, and you will be able to both see and hear this on Houston Media Source at a later date. You can keep in touch with that by joining Execution Watch Facebook and staying in touch that way. Or you can simply keep your ear to the ground or join in one of my Facebook pages or something, and we're going to cover it. But right now, we're going to listen to Robert Garza. Robert, you've been pretty much pushed through a grinder by the system. How do you think the system has treated you, your family, and your case?
I think they've pretty much treated us as just cattle being herded through their slaughter machine. You know what I mean? I think that there's been no personal intervention as far as the appeals process or the trial. Like, nobody's ever bothered to step up and really consider the facts of the case or the facts surrounding my case or the mitigating issues in my trial to present a mitigating case during my trial. So I think it's all just been a more of a mechanical process to where you just put somebody on the conveyor belt and move them along. And I think that's been the situation all along, because there's a lot of issues in my case that have never been heard. They've never been raised. They've never been put before the courts, before my trial courts or my appellate appeals courts.
As a matter of fact, what's pending right now is a pro se motion that you drafted yourself. It wasn't drafted by your lawyers. You've sent it to the district court, and they have passed it on to Texas Court of Criminal Appeals around the issue of misconduct in handling evidence in your case.
The state withholding evidence, the prosecution. I mean, it's a number of things. I mean, for one, the vehicle that was used at the crime, according to the district attorney's theory, when they found it, when I got arrested about 6 months prior to me getting arrested, or a couple months prior to me getting arrested, they had raided somebody's house for car theft. A group of people that were stealing vehicles. They raided their house, and they actually found the license plates to that vehicle at their house. And they, according to my understanding, they questioned them about this case, about the Donna case. But that was never made known to my defense team. I was made aware of that after I got here through friends who knew that group of people that were arrested and picked up and questioned about those license plates to that vehicle. Because that vehicle, one of the big issues in my case about how they identified the vehicle was that it had paper plates. And when they raided these people's houses, they found the original plates to the truck, and they found paper plates that were blank that you could fill in yourself.
Sure, yeah.
The example.
Dealer plates, yeah.
Yes. And, well, these people, we don't know each other. I don't know who they are. To this day, I don't know who they are. I've never met them. We've never had any kind of contact. So that's one of the issues that the district attorney never gave to my defense team to question. We never were able to investigate that aspect of their theory because they never let us, they never gave it to us. They never gave us that information.
So the police and the prosecutors knew about whereabouts of evidence to the vehicle used in the crime.
Yes.
But they did not share that with the defense team. That's exculpatory evidence.
Yes.
The defense team needs to know everything that they know in order to prepare an adequate defense. And what was your state of the mind at that point of the trial?
Well, at the point of the trial, I was 19. I was a young gangster, a gang member. You know, I had never been on trial for anything before. And you know, all my experiences with the system have been in juvenile. You know, so in juvenile, you don't really get no trial, none of that. It's just you go in front of the judge.
It's a hearing.
The judge tells you where you're going.
Actually,
you go.
It's not even criminal court. It's civil
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, you go where the judge tells you to go. So that was my experiences with the courts. So when I go to this trial, I'm kind of just sitting there letting it take its course. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because this is the only way I've ever known. You know, I didn't come to understand all the appeals process and how you fight a case and case law and none of that till after I got here.
You weren't mature enough. You weren't experienced enough to be much help to your defense. Anyway, this is a process in which you were passive.
Yeah, so I kind of just sat there and kind of expected my attorney to do his job, basically.
And you didn't know what that was.
And I'm kind of just going along with whatever he says, assuming that he knows what he's doing, you know, because he's an attorney and I'm just, you know, I'm just straight off the streets, you know. So I didn't really know too much about, I mean, I couldn't help him, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't know, I mean, I couldn't tell him where to go, how to look, how to investigate, what cases to look up. None of that should be of any help to him. So I kind of just sat there, you know, and at the time I was still kind of caught up in that mentality, you know what I mean? That young thug mentality to where it was kind of careless about the situation.
Yeah, it's them over there and me over here and I'm helpless.
And basically, you know, well, I mean, they're going to get me anyway, you know what I'm saying? Because I'm already here. I'm already in jail. I'm already charged. They already got me locked up. So this is just a process that we go through. And at the end of it, they tell you where you're going and they send you, you know?
And at the end of it, they send you.
And that's kind of the way it went, you know?
And they sent you here.
And they sent me here. I've been on death row since December of 2003.
There were other people in this case?
There was people charged in the case because I'm here under a law of parties. So there's people charged. There was people charged in this case. But I was the first one to go to trial. So the case was so weak, it's so circumstantial, because there's no eyewitnesses. The only eyewitness that they had, his name was Coco, well, that was his nickname, his name was Quintero. He testified at my trial, and he was the state's sole eyewitness.
He was their heavy hitter.
And he testified in trial that it wasn't me who he saw shooting the guns, because he was about maybe 15 yards away. So he watched the whole thing take place. So he said it wasn't me. So the case is pretty much all circumstantial. So once they got me and they took me to trial and they convicted me, sent me to death row, they kind of just dropped everybody else's charges and left it at that. You know? So there's people that whose charges got dropped because they had other cases. So like one of my co-defendants that was charged on this case, he has some robbery charges. So they just gave him a life sentence on that, dropped this case, and that was the end of that.
In other words, you were the revenge for the incident that you were, at best, a spectator.
Yeah, and they got me. They dropped their charges, but they had other charges, so they sentenced them for those cases, and that was the end of that. You know, There's one guy that they're still looking for, and I've had a lot of problems. Like, we hired an investigator to try to help my attorney go look up some records and stuff, like the stuff that I'm saying that they've been withholding this whole time. Okay, well, they won't give us none of that stuff because they're saying that it's still an open case. Because I have a fall partner, a co-defendant, who's never been caught. So this whole time, there's supposed to be...
So they're still withholding evidence.
There's still stuff that they're not handing over because their excuse is that it's an open case. So they can't give it to us.
Is that in your current motion?
No. Because I've never seen what they have. So I don't know what to ask for. I don't know what to bring up because I've never seen the police reports. Since it's an open case, like every 3 months, they have to give a report, an update on their investigation. Okay, well, that report has a bunch of other information that we try to get during my trial. Well, the DA was saying that the judge shouldn't grant us access to that file because it's an open case.
And it relates to somebody else's cases.
Yes. And since his excuse was that since it's a gang-related issue, that if there's something in there, I say that they're getting close to arresting this guy, and I get the file, and we see something that I would tell them. So they're denying me access to any of the records based on that idea that there might be something in there that I can go tell them. So they're trying to keep their investigation secret. And that's keeping, I mean, we can't really do too much investigating on the investigators' reports and their case because they won't give us access to it.
And so here's the sorry state of American criminal justice. It's a patchwork quilt with so many parts missing that you don't ever get a full picture. And they've got an excuse for every missing part.
And they try to cover parts that they don't want you to see. You know, the quilt only covers what they want to cover. You know what I mean?
That's true.
And that's the thing. Like in my case, they've never accused me of being the shooter. It's never been an issue that I took anybody's life. I said, but if anybody asked the district attorney who was the party in the case, who did he aid and abet in the commission of this crime to take these people's lives? They said, well, they don't know. So in my case, they don't know who pulled the trigger. They don't know who murdered the women. They're just saying that I helped them, but they don't know who I helped. And that's been an issue in my case that it's kind of been hard to raise it in appeal because they're saying, well, he was a party. And I mean, how do I raise the issue of, well, where's the party?
Yeah.
When I don't know where their investigation is going. I don't know who they're naming as a party. I don't know who they're alleging is the party because they won't give me access to their file. So if they have a list of the people that are a party to this crime, could be 5 people, 10 people, 20 people, I don't know because I can't look at their file to see who they're alleging was the party of the crime.
On my way in here, I met your wife and her mother and 3 wonderful children. How have they been treated by this process?
They kind of, you know, I mean, I've never had any attorneys really just try to get them involved in what's going on. You know, kind of my attorney's been kind of standoffish. So really their only dealings is with the prison system, you know, when they come here. And, I mean, they've treated them all right, except I guess my only complaint is today, you know, when it really matters that you would assume that they would be, you know, more careful with what they're doing, it seems that they dropped the ball, you know.
It was supposed to have been visits yesterday that didn't happen?
No, there was, I got my visits yesterday, which was a full day. I got my visits the day before, which were a full day. Today was a half day because of media day.
Yeah.
So visits run from 8 to 12.
They didn't get in until 10.
They didn't get here till 10 because the officer in the front told them that they're not allowed to come see me today. That they either see me today and they can't see me tomorrow, or they see me tomorrow and they can't see me today. Where he got that idea, I don't know.
But somebody got you in. I saw the warden and he said that he got him in at whatever time they came in.
Yeah, as soon as they got here, they let him in. And they, instead of ending my visits at 12 the way they normally do, they let them stay till 1. So I got about 30 minutes, 45 minutes extra.
So you have learned how to defend yourself from other folks on death row.
Yes, there's people here who study the law. You know, there's people here who are actually very smart. And you know, they give me tips. They look here, look there, you know, and help me put stuff together. And then I have friends in the free world who are also, you know, concerned because they know about the details of my case and the way my appeals have gone. So it's a patchwork. We're just patching stuff together, but it seems that our arguments, our paperwork is a lot more legit than what I've had with my attorney. Yeah. I had an attorney in my federal writ. His name is Don Rene. And I had some friends contacting him to try to help him with my clemency petition. And the man tells him, well, he's guilty anyway. What's the point? And this is the man that's supposed to be helping me. So,
I mean, I see I'm not a lawyer.
Yeah.
And I know what law of parties means.
Yeah.
And you just told me what was in your case file, in the testimony, in the trial.
Yeah.
And I don't know how any lawyer could conclude he's guilty anyway. That just doesn't even make sense.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, now I've been asking, you know, because he has a lot of people on death row that he represents, at least 8 or 9. And it seems that he does that frequently. there's another guy that's on death row, that's on death watch right now. His date's on October 9th. And he told his friends the same thing. There's no point in doing clemency because he's guilty.
I have one reliable audience for the radio show, and that's the guys on the road.
Yeah.
I mean, they will stretch speaker wire from hell and gone to catch that show.
Yeah.
And we got a repeater just a few blocks from here so that they can get a good signal.
Yeah.
Give that lawyer's name again. And you fellas on the row, when you hear this name, if you got anything to say about this lawyer's, shoot me a kite. Is that true?
Yes, sir.
Because I ain't going to edit what
because,
this is.
Because that's the issue I've brought up to my friends, that they keep assigning this man cases on death row, and he's doing patchwork. You see, he's filed people's briefs with my name on them, on somebody else's. It's got my name, somebody else's arrest date.
Called the word processor practice of law.
And all he's doing is changing names and dates and refiling stuff. And his name's Don Rene. He's from New Mexico. And they keep assigning them cases, and it seems like The dude does the same thing from what I've gathered. You know, he does the same thing with pretty much everybody he's helping. He was Ross's attorney, too, and he just got executed.
Yeah.
And it was the same thing with him. You know, what do you want a clemency petition for if in Texas they don't grant it? You know, I mean.
Well, we interviewed Ross, and it was my impression that he wasn't much help in his own case because he was kind of out of it.
Yeah.
He had lost it. I don't know whether he lost it on the row or whether he never had it. But you know, conditions on the row are pretty bad.
Yeah, yeah.
You go crazy.
Get pretty bad. Yeah, you can. A lot of people lose it, you know. I guess I've been fortunate to have my family and my kids and my wife and my life, you know. And I've had a good group of friends around me that kind of, you know, keep me focused. But not everybody's fortunate enough to have that, you know. And some people just... They lose it, you know.
Well, I told you before the interview that I'd looked over your filing.
Yeah.
And I thought there was a pretty good chance that this wasn't going to happen tomorrow.
Yeah.
But then I ain't in the system. I'm just an outside observer. You ready for this if it happens?
Well, I mean, I ain't really got no choice. You know what I'm saying? It's like, if it happens, I can't stop it. I'm in a situation where... I mean, I can't stop it. I can't. So mentally, I've accepted that, you know, that I know I'm on a conveyor belt, and I know the state of Texas doesn't have no problem putting people to die, whether they're guilty or they're mentally retarded or they're innocent, or it's all mechanical. If there's a wrong word on a filing that you file, something you file, that's enough for them, you know. They'll throw out the whole thing based on something that small. So I understand the way it works. So I guess mentally and spiritually, you know, I'm ready if it happens, you know. And I just try to, what I've been trying to do is prepare my family, because my family, you see, my family surrounds me so much, and it's like I'm a pillar in my family now. I have my kids, my wife, my mother-in-law, my mom, my sister, my stepdad, and it's like they've made me the center of their lives for all these years. Mm-hmm. And really, that's my concern. My concern stopped being myself a long time ago, because I finally grew up and I started realizing that all these people are kind of, they're very emotionally attached to me. Even though I'm not there, they kind of gravitate towards me. And that's really my main concern, is trying to strengthen them, because I don't know how they're going to take it. You know, I know it's going to be hard for them, especially for my mom and my wife.
Robert, the image you just patched together is the image I want, if I have to use this, the world to remember about you. But if you've got a better thing that you want to say, that's your camera. Look in it and say what you want to.
I mean, that's basically it. I mean, the truth of the matter is that when I got here, I was a young thug. I grew up on the streets. I was a gang member. My life was surrounded with negativity. But since I've been here, I've grown up, and I've taken the time to self-analyze myself, to get to know myself and who I became and how I became that person, and not like that person, because now I understand that lifestyle is not necessary. You know, a lot of us, it's a trap. A lot of us fall into that lifestyle without really knowing. But once you realize it, I guess that's where you have the choice to either change it or stay in it. And I made the choice to leave that behind and become a better person. It's understanding that it might not be much in this process that I'm going through. You know, like clemency, it doesn't do no good for that, because they don't even consider it. But I did it because it's the right thing to do, and for my family. And I'm not the same person I was when I first got here. And for the jury to say that we can't change 11 years ago is just wrong. Because if they see me today, if they just gave me a chance to talk to them, I'm sure their opinion would change.
Robert Garza, thank you very much for permitting this interview.
And at that point, I raised my hand, indicating to Mark Purcell that the interview was over. We have not edited anything from that interview. I'm responsible for what I said. Robert Garza is responsible for what he said. I need to inform you that as of this point, at 6:47:43, there has been no crossing of the road in Huntsville. So apparently the Supreme Court has found some justification for the hitch on a Cumberland. Care to speculate, Jim?
Sleeping.
Sleeping. They all went to bed and just said, we'll put this off till tomorrow.
Probably did.
Well, the window to execute someone in Texas is from 6 p.m. until midnight. The prison system says, if we don't get word before 10 o'clock, it ain't happening.
Gotcha.
And so we're only 48 minutes into that window. But Mike has been thinking about some aspects of this case. Mike, why don't you...
Well, being an attorney, I think from attorney's viewpoints. And the thing about this case that I find very interesting is what a spot the attorney was put into. One of the things we've talked about in this show before is an inefficiency of counsel. This man accuses lawyers of inefficiency of counsel. In other cases we had, there was a problem. But in this case, this man did his work, he got his witnesses, the court's fine, he did a full investigation, he had all the evidence in his pocket to present to court, but then all of a sudden, something happened that he wasn't expected, he didn't have to. And what I mean by that is they did not bring up the Edinburgh Massacre. That's big.
He was ready for it.
He he was ready. He had doctors ready. He had family members ready. He had people ready in order to talk. But he didn't bring them up. And the question becomes, why would you not bring in the two psychologists who were paid to talk about why this man should not get the death penalty? Why would you not bring in the family members to show what we just heard, how there's been a change in this person? Why not bring this evidence in? The trick with this is once the state puts on its evidence and they rest, they're done. Until the defense lawyer puts on evidence.
Then they've got another bite at the apple.
Exactly correct.
Okay.
He, I think, what I'd be... is not understanding. They had that horrible Edinburgh massacre.
And he knew they had that.
And they had
announced.
And they had confessions. They had disclosed it beforehand. He's waiting for this horrible scenario where the man confessed to this horrible situation, and it didn't come. Now it's not going to come in unless he puts on witnesses. There was another factor. This guy's unbelievable. Talking to his own psychologist, he confesses to another murder and other assaults. The interesting part is when the state put their notice of what they were going to use, they did not put in those elements. But they could have got him in by cross-examining the doctors.
Sure.
So all of a sudden, the lawyer's in
a dilemma. So if the lawyer had presented any mitigating evidence in the world, he opened himself up to a horror story.
Well, two things. The witnesses would be opened up to cross-examination about what the man told him. And second of all, that information did not come in. Then when they went again on rebuttal, they could then bring up the Edinburgh massacre. He was trying, I believe, to keep that massacre out. This is a tough call for a lawyer.
Okay, Mike. Thank you very much for that. I want to get Jack in here because Jack has been working on... look, this kid is not a kid. To me, he's a kid because I'm 72 years old, and he's a youngster compared to that. But he committed whatever it is he did, and apparently he admitted to doing a lot, and there's a lot of evidence leading to a lot, as a gang member in the Valley. When he was 19 years old and younger.
And been a gang since he's been 9 years. Really a gang member more of his life than he was. Joined when he was nine.
He joined the gang when he was nine.
Years.
And in that 10 years, he racked up a good bit.
Yep.
Thing. What the hell's going on with the youth? I got an Asian fella here talking about Latin American youth in the Valley. But you got any ideas, Jack?
Sure. I mean, I think whether you're Asian, you're black, you're Latin, white, it's if you have a group of young boys who are pre-adolescent or hitting their adolescence, they all boys clump together. Boys. Boys do activities together. We play games together. We play ball together. We have a tendency to clump together. And within that context, there's usually an alpha male that shows up. In the competition, in the comings and goings of what boys do and young men do, there is typically an alpha male. And part of what happens is that boys clump together because there's a desire and there's
talking about the Lord of Flies theory.
Yeah, actually it is. That we all want.
If you haven't read that, get and read it. Lord of Flies.
Yeah, actually I think that's exactly right. Boys want to belong. We all want to belong to a group, something that is bigger than ourselves. And this is part of growing up and figuring out who you are. And that's part of the reason why gangs are so attractive to boys and young men. And I think the distinction here is that, is it a good gang or is it a bad gang? Is it a gang that sits around and comes up with fun, clever stories and plays and games and things like that? Or is this a gang that decides, hey, you know what? There's a convenience store. Let's knock it over. Let's go rob it. What kind of a gang are you dealing with? Are you dealing with a bunch of kids who are creative, whose objective is to come up with fun and interesting things, or destructive things? It all depends. And again, we all want a sense of belonging. As people, we all want a sense of belonging. And I think boys in particular, boys and young men in particular, need that because that's how we flesh out who we are, the men we are going to become.
Well, it doesn't have to be boys. I've been talking to convicts for the last 30 years, and I have found out that in convict society, there are gangs.
Sure.
And I described them on the prison show for 30 years as gangs are cowards that manipulate weak people. And I get that from them. The cowards in the front office don't do things that they get the weak people to do because they don't want to put themselves in that kind of jeopardy. That makes them cowards. But they get other people to do it. And who do they get to do it? It's weak people.
Sure, you bet.
So if you're going to join a gang, I don't care whether you're 10, 9, 19, or 40, go ahead and join your gang, and you can be a weak people for a long time until you get enough seniority to become a coward.
You know, to illustrate your point, when you think about it, Ray, Charlie Manson was the one that put everybody up to doing what he didn't do.
That's right.
Because he was, you know, kind of the alpha male.
And if it weren't for the law of parties, Charlie Manson
would be... And he was that alpha male you're talking about,
that's
Jack,
exactly
and
right.
They did his bidding. He didn't kill anybody.
You've been listening to the Execution Watch show. It is... believe it or not, it's September the 18th, it's 19th, it's Thursday, 2003. We've been on for the last hour or so talking about Robert Garza. We've let Robert Garza talk about Robert Garza. There is not another place in media that peels the covers back and lets you look at executions as clearly as we do. I've been informed by our wizard that we have broken KPFT's record for online listeners. We now have 559 people listening online, and that is a new record for this radio station. I think what we're doing is important media. I have to constantly ask myself, and I ask Robert, and I ask others, is it important to do this? Everybody seems to think so. If you think it's important enough, go to kpft.org and make a contribution on behalf of Execution Watch. My name is Ray Hill. I've been the host. Our producer is Elizabeth Stein. Our technical director at the wheel is Otis McClay himself. The music theme is Victoria Panetti. I want to thank Jim Skelton, Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Michael Gillespie, Jack Lee. I want to thank Robert Garza for being a part of it. I want to thank Gloria Ruback and Dave Atwood. I want to thank Mark Pirtle for conceptualizing the idea of making this television. And, of course, I want to thank Alex for coming in and taping tonight. My name is Ray Hill. Thank you for listening. Good night.
If you care about what you just heard, please go to kpft.org and support Execution Watch and KPFT by making a donation. The support that makes shows like this possible comes from listeners like you. Thanks for listening.